Call to order the House Judiciary Committee on Wednesday, Friday, excuse me. Present are Representatives Croft, Porter, Green, Bundy, and Berkowitz. We will be joined later by Representatives James and Rolkeberg, who are in process on their other litigation, probably in about 15 minutes. What I would like to do is to reiterate what I would like to do in this committee on this particular bill. The sponsor will take us through the bill for the next hour, plus or minus, depending on questions. I will entertain questions of clarity. I don't want to get into a debate about the substantive part of the bill at this time. We do have several teleconference sites on. We will be taking testimony. There are 8 teleconference sites on. We have the members who want to testify from 2 of those, and we will be getting the rest of them later. The plan then would be that we'll hear the bill explained to us. We'll take testimony today. We'll take testimony on Monday. If necessary, we will extend the meeting into the evening to be sure that we have all testimony. I will close testimony Monday, and we will revisit the bill then as a committee for debate and discussion on Wednesday next. Is there any question among the members? Yes, Representative Croft.
Just wanted to state the obvious for the record that Representative Berkowitz and I provided a quorum for today's discussion.
And the chair recognizes your cooperative attitude, and I truly appreciate that. If there is no other question about the proposal or the program, Representative Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since it's going to be quite a lengthy presentation,
right,
if I could ask Jim Sorrento from my office and join me up here, because we have worked together on this preparation of the bill.
While they're assembling themselves for the teleconferences out there, we have Kenai and Cordova, the people who wish to testify. If the rest of you would get your lists in, I would appreciate it. Representative Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. What I will hope to do is also recognize the chair's wishes to resist the urge to editorialize myself on the provisions of the bill. I will endeavor to, as neutrally as possible, explain what I think, at least, each provision, each section means, and to the extent that understanding is enhanced by what the apparent attempt is, I'll certainly try to provide that. Also try to provide what the change is in terms of what the current law provides. The first section of the bill, obviously, is the intent, and I guess to, I hope, not contradict what I just said, but I think it is worthy of putting on the record at this stage what it is that this whole endeavor is about. And quite frankly, the first section of Section 1 basically says that. And it is to encourage the efficiency of the civil justice system by discouraging frivolous litigation, by decreasing the amount, cost, and complexity of litigation, without diminishing the protection of innocent Alaskans' rights to reasonable but not excessive compensation for tortuous injuries caused by others. That, in a nutshell, is what this is all about. Section 2 is not a substantive part of the bill, but is a minor consistency change. There is a change that you will see in Section 23 that reflects the thought of the governor's task force and of the bill that we presented last year, that the rate prejudgment interest should more adequately reflect the marketplace instead of being a fixed rate. The fixed rate right now is 10.5, and the provision of the bill that you'll see in Section 23 provides a floating rate. This is just a consistency change to leave 10.5 in existence in another section of the banking code because it was referenced to this section. And if for no other reason, single subject, this allows us from going into that section and changing it. We are, again, leaving the banking statute in place and only making this reference as a conformity change to what we've done within Title IX. The next several sections deal with the statute of repose and the statute of limitations. I think to understand what it is that we're attempting to do there, basically there is a requirement for an understanding, as much as a layperson like myself can provide, of what a statute of repose is and what a statute of limitations is. So to that end, let me say in layman's terms that a statute of repose is an outer limit, an absolute outer limit, on when a case can be brought based on how long a period of time has occurred from when the action took place that supposedly caused the injury or the damage that took place. There is, within that period of time, and in the bill, as you'll see, we're proposing an 8-year statute of repose. Within that 8 years, there are varying examples of statute of limitations, and these sections will highlight what those are. Basically, they are an additional limitation, if you will, that says if you know or should have known that this damage or injury took place, that you only have a shorter period of time within which to file a case. My background, Representative Berkowitz's background in the criminal law areas, a statute of limitations on the ability to file a case after a crime has occurred is a very common thing. There are these kinds of limitations on when, how long before you can't go back and try to make a case on a crime, on all levels of crimes except first-degree murder. So one of the more heinous crimes that I ever investigated was first-degree sexual assault. There's a limit on that. Thus, the civil law has the same kinds of limits. And we are suggesting where they should be in several areas. Having said that, then, Section 3 is a section that reflects suggestions also from the governor's task force that actually, Section 3 addresses a law that had contained a 6-year statute of limitations on several provisions. Section 3 reflects what we are leaving as a 6-year statute of limitations. And further limitations will be shown from that law that as it had existed in subsequent sections. Then, matter of fact, the next one is one of those. Contracts actions to be brought in 3 years. This, again, from the governor's task force, imposes a 3-year statute of limitations on contract actions, and is it a reduction from the existing law of three?
Six.
I'm sorry, of six. The next is...
Excuse me. Representative Croft?
Do you want me to intersperse as we go through the section?
Sure. Would it be... Yes.
Yeah, we'll be getting into different areas, so...
Might as well do that.
Then if I can at this point, Mr. Chairman. Representative Porter, this brings in a provision from the governor's task force, and I've seen that in a number of areas where you say it's taken verbatim. Some of the governor's task force conclusions were compromises between doing nothing and doing a more extreme provision. And was it your intent to pull over both the extreme and the compromise? I see in a sectional analysis that we did very often, if it's in either bill, was in yours last year, was in your original, or was in the governor's, it comes over into the sponsor substitute. Are we taking the compromises as well as the original?
In the area of the statute of limitations, I was on the subcommittee that dealt with these, and I think it's fair to say that these provisions were not a result of any discussion of outer limits and a compromise to the middle. This was a suggestion by a member, not myself, a member of the subcommittee, and it was discussed and adopted, and then subsequently adopted by the entire task force. So I don't think this would fall into that category.
I'll bring it up when it
sure.
when it does. And one follow-up.
Representative Croft.
On the statute of repose, was it your intention to keep the discovery rule intact there? That is, somebody who has no earthly way of knowing that a harm has been done to them until 9 years afterwards. Is that barred? Is there any relief for somebody who, through no fault of their own, does not know?
Can I give you a definite yes or no on that? I haven't explained the statute of repose yet, but to that specific question, there certainly could be a situation where someone did not have, for whatever reason, knowledge of an injury or a damage, and the statute of repose had been completed, and that would be a bar to filing a case. There are, as I go through the section that deals with the statute of repose, a number of exceptions where there the statute of repose would not apply, and consequently there would be no limitation from a statute of repose standpoint on a whole bunch of kinds of things, and perhaps it would be helpful to go through that.
I think that's right. As those come up, yeah. We can discuss them.
Come back
but again, it's not a debate portion, it's just for clarification.
Well, I think that recognizing then what a statute of repose is, kind of like the hearsay rule, you can't even talk about the hearsay rule unless you say what all the exceptions are. That's where the real meat of the law is. And I think to an extent, so is the statute of repose. We accept, set aside from the 8-year statute of repose, the following. Any prolonged exposure to hazardous waste, an intentional act, or an act of gross negligence, an act that involved fraud or fraudulent misrepresentation, a breach of an express warranty or guarantee. And I think here, one of the criticisms of a statute of repose is that even people who want to perhaps provide a longer period of time seem to be barred from it. Well, that is not the case. If, for example, we always hear when we talk about a statute of repose about school roofs falling in, well, there aren't any of those on record within this period of time. The school district or the state or any other person, for that matter, building a building is in no way barred from having a contract with the contractor that is commissioned to build this building to have a wider period of statute of repose if they so choose. And if the two parties agree to that, then they have a longer one. And as is in D here, a breach of an express warranty or guarantee is an exception to the 8-year statute of repose if they choose to make a 10-year or whatever they want. I think one of the biggest exceptions is E, the defective product. We took an awful lot of testimony over the last 4 years in the approach that we originally took to the statute of repose about some of the more salient products that have come to light after an 8-year period. The drug that caused deficiencies in children after they were born, taken, ingested by the mother.
Thalidomide.
Thermidylide, yeah, whatever that is. That big drug. And I guess there are other kinds of examples of these things. While in the general scheme of things, you could make an argument for a statute of repose in those kinds of cases, that's one of the, if you will, accommodations and compromises that have already been made in this legislation. We're saying, okay, we're not going to fight that battle today. And quite frankly, I don't intend to fight it ever, but if someone wants to, welcome. The one of the other things that would cause an exception is if the person who was the defendant had intentionally tried to conceal any of the ingredients or elements, if you will, that would go to establish that the injury had occurred or that negligence had occurred. One of the other things that is somewhat unusual, I guess, but it was one of those sticking points and the accommodation was made along the way, the old sponge left in the body after surgery kept coming up and up and up. To that extent, then, on page 4, section C, we told the statute of repose, tolling is a nice legal word for meaning that it's null and void, held in abeyance until this thing is discovered, that if there is a foreign body that has no therapeutic or diagnostic purpose found in a body that in a person's body, that is an exception to the statute of repose.
Representative Berkowitz.
I was going to ask some questions based on these exceptions, just so I'm clear on them. The concept of hazardous waste, does that have some legal definition or the body of law that addresses
it? It is an attempt to address another concern that was raised of the more typical kinds of someone's property leached chemicals into my property and I didn't know about it, those kinds of things. If somebody's got a better definition, we looked around for quite a while, but if somebody's got a better definition for that, I'd certainly look at it. But that's the intent of the whole gamut of reasons where these kinds of arenas are exempted.
Yes, follow up.
There's a couple questions I have related to this.
Okay, if it's for clarity.
It's for clarity. Is there a reason why you chose the term waste instead of material?
There may have been at the time, but if it was, I can't recall it at this time. So.
Well, moving
maybe if you have a suggestion, it'll bring up something and I can...
Moving down the list here, I just want to be clear on this. That if someone commits a criminal act, then they would fall outside the statute of repose?
The exception regarding intentional act would, I'm sure, bring that outside. And
that would include even if the criminal statute of limitations precluded a criminal
yes.
action?
Yeah. The statute of limitations for prosecution wouldn't apply to a civil case.
When you talk about product, the defective product, does that include products, I guess it would fall in sort of the rough category of intellectual property? And I sell you an idea, that idea turns out to cause a problem later on?
Well, the definition, of course, is an object that has intrinsic value, is capable of delivery as an assembled whole or as a component part, and is introduced into trade or commerce. I don't think thoughts would fall into that definition.
And finally, just so I'm clear on this, if there's an indication of intentional concealment, the tolling period begins at what point?
When the when the injury, damage, whatever is discovered, or should have been discovered, and that's put in there obviously so that you can't just say, I didn't know, and pretty hard to prove what's in a person's head, then the two-year statute of limitations would start accruing, but the statute of repose, the eight-year limitation, would be told so that if this discovery were made 10 years after the fact, and it was as a result of an intentional concealment or fraud or something like that, then you would have 2 years to get it in.
Representative Croft.
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman. Representative Porter, the statutes of limitations don't mention it, but do they still contain the discovery rule?
It as a matter of fact, does. The we tried to mention it, and that is that the term, and I will get into it, perhaps we already have, and I guess we did, and I didn't highlight it. From the time of accrual, basically means, and that isn't in statutes right now, but I think it fairly reflects case law, that the statute of limitations begins from the time that you knew or should have known, and that basically is the time of accrual.
So the statute of limitations provisions didn't mean any change in the discovery rule?
That's correct.
But the statute of repose,
Representative Croft,
provisions do. I mean, that's the point of a statute of repose.
By definition, that's correct.
And my original question from before was something that someone has no way of learning, if it doesn't fall into these exceptions, would be barred after 8 years.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Porter.
Okay. Number six is the limitation on actions of health care providers. Basically, it provides that there is an exception. It provides an exception to the statute of limitations for children who are 0 to 6 years old. It, by its first statement, notwithstanding the disability of a minor, shortens an exception that currently exists in law that provides that minors, that the statute of repose, if you will, is told for minors, for incompetent persons, and in cases of adult recollection of child abuse when the memory was suppressed and comes to light for some reason when they're an adult. There are those three exceptions to the statute of repose in existing law. One of them, as I say, is an exception for minors. We're changing that exception in this statute to one of 18 years to one of basically 8 years. This would result then that the statute of repose would be in place for these kinds of cases, for injuries, if you will, done to children who are at birth injuries, for example, and any time up until they're six. The statute of limitations is told, but the statute of repose fits with this.
Representative Croft, question.
Was there a statute of repose before, or was simply a tolling of the statute of limitations up to majority of 18 years?
The statute of repose in the statutes previously was in there, and then it was out, and then it was in, and then it was out, based on what the legislature did and what the courts did. I don't know when this exception of the three things that I mentioned was put into law, but it would have stayed in effect during this transition of up and down, in and out statutes of repose anyway.
And just one more, the same effect of the other statute of repose, that if it doesn't fall within an exception, it doesn't matter whether they knew or reasonably should have known of their cause of action. It's an absolute bar.
It begs an editorial response, but I will not make one.
Please continue, Representative Porter.
Section 7 basically, again, confirms a reduction that is the final portion of the section that I told you about where everything had a six-year, and again brings in the suggestions of the task force for recovery of damages for personal property that puts that at 2 years instead of at six. The keeps the language regarding penalties and forfeitures to the state, and clarifies there were some case decisions that at least some litigation that occurred over what should have been obvious, but because the statutes didn't provide that an intentional act can be considered a tort, that this clarifies the fact that negligence or an intentional act can result in a claim for civil damages and be recognized, and civil damages can be awarded. Okay. This brings us to the beginning of another section that I think would probably be of benefit to the non-lawyers to basically explain the kinds of damages that can be sought in tort cases. I guess maybe even more basic than that, a tort is a civil wrong. A tort is something that results in injury or damage to someone's property or to their person as a result of an act committed or an omission by somebody else that was negligent or grossly negligent or, as we've clarified, intentional. When that happens to you, there are three areas of claims that you can make: economic, non-economic, and punitive. Economic damages are those damages that have resulted from the action that caused the damage or the injury. And they are meant to make the plaintiff in this case whole, to the extent that if this injury required medical attention and medical costs, economic damages would provide those costs. If the injury was sufficient to require future medical costs, economic damages cover all future medical costs. If you were seriously injured and as a result of that lost a leg, any type of false assistive technology that you could get a false leg, or adjustments in your home to accommodate your wheelchair, any of those kinds of things are economic damage, actual costs that can be determined by reasonable people that accrue because of this injury or this damage. If you have to be retrained because you can't work anymore in the occupation that you were in, that is an economic damage. If you can't work and you got cut off in the middle of a career, the future earnings that you have lost are economic damages. Some of the other sections deal specifically with those kinds of things, but virtually anything that you can think of that you can rationally say is a cost or a reasonable projected cost that accrues because of this injury or this property damage is economic damage. There is no limit in this bill, intended or actual, to economic damage recoveries. Having said that, there's non-economic damages and punitive damages. Those are the areas this bill seeks to put an outer limit on. Non-economic damages are those damages that are provided to compensate for such things as pain and suffering, the physical impairment or disfigurement, loss of enjoyment of life, loss of consortium, and other non-pecuniary damage. Thought I had all those terms down. These are obviously the subjective kinds of concerns that plaintiffs have, and certainly are recognizable and understandable. The problem with them is that they are debatable. They don't provide the opportunity for someone to objectively say, like figuring future earnings, that you made this, you're likely to have been promoted twice, your base salary was this, the economy's going to be good, should have made that. You can lay that out. What the result, mental result to someone from an injury or their family, to the loss of a family member. Real? Absolutely. Definable? Difficult. It is for those reasons that we're suggesting caps on punitive and non-economic. Currently, the law provides a cap of $500,000 in the area of non-economic damages, with the exceptions of serious injury or disfigurement. There isn't a definition in the law provided. Consequently, serious injury or disfigurement is a pretty nebulous exception.
Representative Berkowitz.
I'm sorry, but you reminded me why I only do criminal law here. But there is no cap for serious physical injury.
Right.
Okay.
Or disfigurement.
Or disfigurement. So that will include loss of a limb?
I'm sure that serious injury would include loss of a limb. That's what we're suggesting in our proposal. Serious injury, of course, is a relative term, and disfigurement is a relative term. That's why what we're trying to do is cause a degree of certainty so that a whole lot of otherwise ambiguous terms just get litigated case by case. If we say what we mean, hopefully there won't be any need for a trial or points to be litigated.
Maybe I'm not getting this, but Section C1, you talk about various forms of plegia, mm-hmm. limitations on damages, but are those not, would that not constitute serious physical injury to which there should be no limits? And yet there's a
well, we're saying that there should be a limit for non-economic damages. I mean, what we're providing in Section 8 is limits to both areas of non-economic damages. What we're saying is the limit should be $300,000, but in the case of serious physical injury, if you want to put it that way, we'll say what serious physical injury is, so there won't be any debate on it, and we say that the cap on that should be $500,000.
Follow-up.
And that is a change from the unlimited
clarification,
cap.
Follow-up.
Clarification. I just want to get this straight. So if I lose my arm, there's no limit on damage that I can collect. I mean, if it's gone. But if there's some kind of neurological damage, there's a
talking
there's
about
an existing
existing law. That's true.
Yes. Maybe. Let me tell you what it is under existing law.
Okay.
And then what it is we're proposing, and I think that'll bring it into scope. Existing law says that there is a cap of $500,000 for non-economic damages. But in those cases that have serious injury or disfigurement, that cap is removed. So under existing law, if you could establish that loss of an arm, which I think you wouldn't have a great difficulty doing, was a serious injury, there would be no cap on
currently
on what you would be able to request for non-economic damages. What we're suggesting is that there be a cap of $300,000 in, if you will, less serious kinds of injuries, and that for the more serious kinds of injuries, and we are providing somewhat like the theory of workers' comp, we're providing what we think very objectively sets out what is a serious injury. But in those cases, the cap moves only from 300 to 500, not to unlimited.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification, but did you say earlier that there were some instances where there were unlimited damages, or are, as your legislation proposed, that there are no instances where they're unlimited?
That's correct.
Non-economic.
Representative Croft?
I'm sorry. I think he said non-economic, he meant economic.
There's no limit.
No limit on economic damage.
There is, that's correct.
Yes.
There is no limit proposed for all of those multitude of areas of economic damages. No, no limits at all.
Okay.
Representative Croft?
Thank you. Quickly, Mr. Chairman, this covers death. So it's a cap on non-economic damages for a wrongful death.
Yes.
What are the economic damages of death? What's the other side of that? I mean,
all of the, well, to the family of the person that was killed,
wages.
They would be able to claim all of the things that we just talked about, all of the medical expenses, of course, that may have accrued. Any expenses that are a result of the death, which morbidly are internment and those kinds of things. But I think most importantly, the kinds of losses that they would have because of his or her inability to earn a living. Speaking of the breadwinner of the family, whichever that happened to be. Any projected wages that would have accrued to the family or to that individual would still be a viable claim under economic damages to the heirs, dependents of that individual.
Thank you.
I'm going to do one thing here because we're getting into this, and I think it was well that you brought this out, the three kinds of damages, and that we are talking about civil actions. For the benefit of some who may not be familiar, as some of the members of this committee are, I think I'm going to review one thing here. You mentioned earlier that this does not cover criminal actions, and yet if a civil action can be brought in the commission of a criminal act, and that still, and I'm thinking for the simplicity of some people, like the OJ thing, there was a criminal trial for the act by the state, and then there was civil damage act brought up in this last trial, and that you're not changing any of that. That possibility still exists, and you're only talking about the second trial of the OJ section.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Berkowitz, I'm sorry.
Wait.
You guys all look the same.
Yeah. It's that Anchorage Spinarva. I just want to have an idea of how many type of cases we're talking about in Alaska would even come close to this cap. How many cases that, you know, roughly annually do we have that exceed the cap? How many do you expect to brush up against it?
One of the problems that exists in being able to provide that answer, which is a very valid question, that was developed, the problem was developed and defined by the task force also. Of all the tort cases that are filed, the best estimate of the court system is that I think it's 5% of them settle prior to trial. The effect of the provisions of the law currently on economic, non-economic, and punitive damages really can't be determined from 95% of the cases because they're sealed, closed settlements and are non-public. When we get to that section, and I'll just tell you about it now, there is a section that provides that the basic data from these settlements, not the names, but the information that could tell us what the effect of the law really is on the result of these cases, what the claim was, what the finding was, what the amount was provided, will be furnished by the court to the judicial council, compiled so that in the future we can see whether this is having the kind of effect that we're looking for. Within that information that they were able to obtain, they took a look at 1 year, I believe, 1995. In this 5% of the cases that actually went to trial, as I recall, they found that 1 out of 20 actually had awards for non-economic damages. No, 1 in 5 had awards for non-economic damages. 1 in 20 had awards for punitive damages. I don't recall, and as people from the task force testify, you can ask, and maybe their recollection is better than mine, I don't recall if they had the information as to how many of those approached what these caps would provide. And I don't know if they did or not.
For that issue, last week, no, I guess it was earlier this week, Art Snowden made a presentation to the joint committees in the Senate and gave some statistics on various kinds of cases, and I see that we have Chris Christensen in the audience. If that's important now, it might be that we could visit that in a little later, unless that's of an issue to you now. We can.
I can get that
okay.
Information, just knowing where to go. And just
okay. The next, Mr. Chairman, Section 9 then deals with the area of punitive damages, which is no small portion of this piece of legislation. I think it is established law and by case law, at least stated by the Alaska Supreme Court, that the intent of punitive damage is not compensation. The intent of compensation to the plaintiff, the intent of punitive damages is to assess a punishment on a defendant whose behavior, the acts that caused the damages, were so outrageous that they needed recognition of that and dealing with that to the extent that that individual or that company, if you will, needs to be sent a message that that behavior should not reoccur and that anyone else in a similar position with the opportunity to do those kinds of things should be deterred from doing that by an award against this person of punitive damages. Obviously quite consistent with the theory of crime and punishment. The language defining what the level of evidence is, the kind of behavior is not in statute now, but is, we feel, and I don't think there's any argument that malice or conscious act showing deliberate disregard of another person basically is taken out of existing case law, where the Supreme Court has indicated their thoughts about what constitutes that level of behavior.
McDonald's cup of coffee would not be under punitive damage type thing.
Well, McDonald's cup of coffee was found to be in the punitive damage
area. But if this were to be enacted?
It could be.
Okay.
It could be.
Representative Croft.
Quickly, Mr. Chairman. The language here looked very familiar to me, too. Are you intending a change in the law or encapsulating the case law that's developed?
No, it should not represent a change. It should just encapsulate case law.
Representative Berkowitz.
By the term person, we're talking about legal persons, which would include corporations as well?
Could a corporation be found guilty of punitive damages?
Yes. And I mean, that's my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Follow up?
Yes.
By using the term person, I mean, there are corporate entities that, such as partnerships, that don't have legal personage. I guess that's the correct term. Would these fall outside the reach of this?
Well, what the word person in the definition, of course, is meant to describe the plaintiff, the injured party.
Mr. Chairman, by the person from whom the punitive damages are sought.
What line are you on?
First line, page 6.
Other person, by the person from whom the punitive, okay. Person in that context would certainly mean the entity as well as the person, yes.
Porter?
Okay, the section 10 then goes on within punitive damages to establish what the cap on punitive damages is. And currently, there is no cap. This provides that the cap on punitive damages is $300,000 or 3 times compensatory damages, whichever is greater, so that in a very small type of claim where the person's actual loss amounted to $1,000 and there was an additional award of non-economic damages of $9,000, the total compensation would be $10,000. 3 times that would be 30, so that would not be the limit. The limit would be $300,000. Cases where total compensatory damages, which is the sum of economic and non-economic damages, when it's substantially higher than that, then the cap would be 3 times that. I guess I hate to get started down this road, but the biggest punitive damage type case that we've had in Alaska in recent memory is the Exxon Valdez case. And it was in the federal courts, and this law does not affect the federal jurisdiction. It was actually a maritime, which even further isolates it from our laws. But the award had that whole case unfolded under this law in state court would still have been capable of punitive damage. We have provided in this legislation to that an expansion, if you will, of the limit of $300,000 or 3 times compensatory. We did this because, again, we tried to look at the work of the task force, recognize some of the philosophies that it incorporated, and to the extent that, in the opinion of myself and many others that are interested in tort reform, did not severely compromise the total package of the bill that we feel is necessary to be able to achieve the goals of reduced costs and insurance. So to that end, this is a narrow exception, admittedly, that would provide 4 times compensatory damages or $600,000 in those cases where the wrongful conduct or the omission was occurred in the activity of a commercial enterprise, and that the likelihood of death or serious vital injury from this activity was previously known by the persons responsible, and that it continued in face of actual knowledge that their behavior or their omission actually was going to result in more serious physical injury or death. I have not specifically read the case, but it's my understanding that that basically was what was proven in the Ford Pinto case. That is another one that you hear about a lot in discussions in these areas. Section 11.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Cross.
Two quick questions on Section 10. You mentioned federal jurisdiction. This would still limit damages. All of the provisions of this would still apply in any diversity action in federal court.
I'd like Jim to respond to that.
Having been a federal law clerk in my youth, Mr. Chairman, the answer is yes.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm Jim Sorant. I'm aide to Brian Porter.
Thank you.
And the answer is yes. In a federal diversity case, the federal courts look to the substantive law of the state. And so in that case, the federal court would definitely look to this law.
I was a federal law clerk in my youth, too. Second question quickly. You mentioned, for Representative Porter, you mentioned the goals of punitive damages, send a message, deter others, and mentioned the Pinto case. And you chose a method here. How do we know this is enough to send a message? I'll get a message if somebody finds me 10,000. The Ford may not. How do we know that 300 or 600 is enough to send the message or deter others?
Don't need to bother it. We're drifting. Representative Croft, we are not in debate. We are only for clarification. I think you understand what 300,000, 400,000, four times. That's not an appropriate question. That's out of order.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, it's certainly a question that we will discuss at the tail end. But
probably ad nauseum when we discuss it in committee. Representative Berkowitz.
How many cases, going back to 1995, actually had punitive damages?
I can't remember the total number of cases that they pulled to represent that 5% in of all the cases in 95. The statistic that I'm recalling is that 1 in 20 of them had punitive damage awards.
That's less than 1%.
1 in 20 is 5%.
It's about 5.
Well, it's 5% of, it's 5% of 5%, so that's less than...
Well, again, this may get closer to debate, but I guess what it is that the section that we've got the data collection for settlements is aimed at is trying to determine what effect on claims or on awards, settled awards, the claim of punitive damage has had.
Well, I'm not going.
You're
I'm
dangerously
not
going, close, Representative.
I'm not going over the danger zone, Mr.
Okay.
How many of those punitive damage awards brushed up against the limits here?
Again, I don't know.
And just so I know, so I don't have to keep asking, this information is contained in.
If it exists, it's contained in the research that was done by the staff to the task force. And that was done by the Judicial Council. And as I say, I don't remember whether they gathered that particular information or not.
One final question.
Representative Berkowitz.
And this is, even though I never was a federal law clerk.
Nor was I.
And for which I'm grateful. This question of diversity, if there were to be another Exxon Valdez type case, would punitives be affected?
From a non-federal law clerk, I've heard this debated, and there the Exxon Valdez case had another peculiarity. Because it was something that occurred on the high seas, it was a case that brought in the Federal Maritime Act, which is a still further, which is a separation, I'm told, and that the likelihood, there's never say never, but the likelihood that that case would have been diverted into state court is not very much. That's about as close as I can get on that one.
Let the record reflect that Representative James has joined us. Representative Porter.
Okay, moving right along to Section 11. This is a section of periodic payments. Periodic payments are those payments that start after a judgment is in and an award has been made, and the award takes into account, as I explained when we were talking about economic damages, for example, future earnings. Periodic payments provide the principle that the compensation of future earnings might occur over a period of years so as to more closely represent the earnings as they would have come when they were awarded. The current law provides that the plaintiff may elect to have periodic payments if the plaintiff chooses, doesn't provide this opportunity for the defendant to say, I would prefer to pay this future earnings over future rather than a lump sum right now. As you can imagine, there's very good editorializing that could be done at this point, but I will not do it. The substantive change here is allowing the defendant or the plaintiff to elect for periodic payments, as opposed to existing law, which only allows the plaintiff to make this election. The bill additionally provides that the future earnings would be reduced by the amount of income tax that would have accrued against these earnings at the rate that exists at the time of the judgment. Currently, that reduction is not made, and it is felt represents compensation that this person would not have received had they not been injured and worked and received this money as wages. It provides that any time the IRS code changes to the extent that a portion or all of the payment that currently is taxed but then changed wouldn't be, that changes and those adjustments are made.
Representative Porter, that would apply as our income tax rates. I think we're going to put a chair in front of that door. As the rates change, as they have in the past, this type of payment would float with that. What about a single payment? I guess it's not a perfect world. You do that based on the current income tax rate, and would that be reduced from single payment?
The IRS code changes, has changed. I'm trying to think. There isn't an adjustment suggested or in the law for a bulk payment, or because quite a bit of a bulk payment would be in the area of economic and non-economic, and I believe that those two categories are not except for taxes, except for wages. are not taxed. The medical compensation, the non-economic damages are not taxed now.
Representative Berkowitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Porter, I can't even hardly do my own taxes sometimes. So I'm wondering who would calculate the amount of tax that would have been done.
It would be probably an agreement between the parties, so basically what the rates would be. I mean, the rates themselves are the rates that are in effect at the time of the judgment, so that's pretty straightforward. What the level of compensation was going to be, or was projected to be, if the two parties couldn't agree on that, would be a decision for the...
Representative Croft.
A little confused by this, Representative Porter. If, assuming the entire award is taxable, they're going to have to pay, and assuming it's all done in the lump sum, they're going to have to pay taxes on it. I just don't understand how it works. If we reduce the award by an estimated 15% tax, do they then pay 15% on the remainder? I mean, is it, or does the defendant give it to the IRS? Assuming an entirely taxable award, what is the intent? What happens with this?
Well, I think that's the problem. I don't think that's a good assumption. Most of that portion of the award in a lump sum award is not taxable. Very little of it is. So to the extent that is, we're just saying, okay. But it is very clear on long extended future earnings awards that it is a windfall, if you will, to receive, if it's projected that you were supposed to make $50,000 a year for the next 30 years, you would have paid whatever tax on that money for that whole period of time. Currently, when you receive a future wage judgment, that is based on the total amount that you would have earned, and there is no deduction for the amount of taxes that you would have paid. So,
follow up,
Croft.
Points well taken that most of a judgment is non-economic and therefore not taxable. So just taking the part that is taxable, if I say you would have made $100,000 a year and in the death you're making zero, and so under the old rule I'd give you $100,000 a year, under this rule I'd reduce it by the estimated taxes. My understanding is if it would have been a taxable thing, a wage, that person is going to have to pay the tax. So if I give them the $100,000, that does appear like a windfall, but then they pay taxes on that portion. I'm simply trying to get to, isn't this being taxed twice? And I'll work on understanding that this weekend.
I guess the answer to that, I believe the answer to the question is that person would not have to pay the tax. That's where the windfall comes in. Future economic.
Not my understanding of it, but I'll clarify it.
Representative Berkowitz.
Representative Porter, I would probably wind up talking to you about this anyhow, but just so I'm talking on the right page. Say I owe you $100 and you paid $20 taxes, I would pay you $80 under this arrangement?
Well, under this arrangement, if this was something that you were going to pay me over a long period of time, I would say yes. The theory being that under existing law, because of the nature of the payment, I would not have to pay tax on it. So if you owed me that amount of money, you could get away with paying me less than what I would have earned, because actually the only thing that I would have in my pocket if I were working would be the, if using your, say, $100 and
just easy for me to
10, okay. If nothing had happened to me and I would have had this income over the next 10 years, my actual net income would have been $90 a year. If the amount of gross pay that I receive is the $100, right now the courts are awarding future economic damages in the area of $100 because that's my gross, and then you would have to pay me $100 when in effect, and that's not taxable. Under current IRS law, that's not taxable. Because it is a future economic damage award from this kind of case, that's the fact. But to make me whole, really, would only require $90 a year. So that's what we're saying that a defendant should have to pay. It's what it is that is required to make him whole, not, if you will, a windfall of that tax money that he would have otherwise had to pay.
Berkowitz?
And so I'm paying less than the compensatories I owe you, and the IRS is the one that gets cut out of the loop?
For the specific future earnings section of all of these potential claims, yes. IRS isn't out of the loop because they wouldn't have taxed it in the first place.
I'll come talk to you about this.
Representative Porter, please continue.
Okay.
Excuse me. We'll let the record reflect that Representative Roekberger has joined us.
The next section, Section 12. No, Section 12.
Mm-hmm.
12?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is the section that specifically provides the fact, as I said at the beginning of periodic payments, that either party, the plaintiff or the defendant, can select this. And that if the plaintiff is represented by an attorney on a contingent fee arrangement, that so that the attorney does not have to remain in this loop of payments that go out for 10, 20 years, that the contingent fee is reduced if it's required to present value and paid, so that the remainder then is put on periodic payment.
Representative Bundy?
And just conjecture here, but if the attorney wanted to stay part of the periodic payout, would they be allowed, or are they precluded from that?
They would be allowed, I presume, but I don't think that that's going to happen.
Yeah, but
it would be a contract between them.
There isn't a prohibition there, I don't think, though.
Well, bird in the hand.
Yes.
One of the concerns, of course, in these kinds of settlements is that, basically they break down into a structured settlement or an annuity, and one of the concerns, of course, is what's the guarantee that this money is going to be there when these things come due? Consequently, we require the court to make sure that there is security in the establishment of these payments. And we are providing that, is it in this section there? Subsequent sections where we're saying the breeding companies.
What's the next one?
I think it's 13.
13.
It's 13? Okay. In section 13, we're providing that accepting for posting of security from the state or self-insured municipalities and insurance companies authorized to do business. But then we're adding to that, considering universal life. If their financial strength is in the highest two categories as measured by any two nationally recognized independent rating services, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, the other two, whatever
that is,
they have a range of 5 and sometimes 6, I think, rating. We're saying that in order to meet the criteria of a secure annuity or structured settlement, that they have to be in the top 2 as a matter of interest. Universal Life was in the 3rd. Didn't stay there very long. But
that was Executive Life.
Executive Life, I'm sorry, not Universal Life. Executive.
I thought that was a religious experience he was talking about.
And the same, whether this is structured settlement or annuity, that same criteria for a secure annuity.
Representative Berkowitz, we're running into a time crunch. We're either going to have to speed up the pace or reduce the questions or something.
I will try to speed up.
Going to be here long. Representative Berkowitz.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll be quick. This is done at the Section 12 is done at the request of either party.
Yes.
So even if the injured party wanted a lump sum,
that is correct. Section 14 basically allows the future payments to take into consideration inflation and provides what that rate would be so that value of the compensation increases or stays the same, I should say. Collateral benefits. I'll try to give you, since we are already running out of time, I'll try to give you the quick down and dirty in collateral benefits. Collateral benefits basically are those things that a plaintiff receives in compensation, if you will, from other sources rather than from the defendant in terms of a judgment that the defendant has to pay. If you are driving your car and are injured because of the negligence of someone else, you have car insurance, and the car insurance will pay for the repair of your car, will pay for your medical bills and those kinds of things based on what your insurance coverage is. Currently, the jury at the subsequent trial of the person who negligently hit you is not allowed to hear that these other collateral sources exist and actually have, in many cases, paid some of the costs of the claims that the plaintiff is making. What happens now is after the jury renders its judgment, then the defendant can bring in to the judge evidence of these other collateral sources, and the judge then makes a determination of how much the judgment should be reduced based on what the other collateral sources are. After that is done, then the what often happens is the person that furnished that collateral source has to sue the defendant to try to recover that based on a whole new trial of establishing that negligence. And since they had to pay it and that there was their responsibility, that they should refund the money to the collateral source, the source of the collateral source, if you will. Consequently, what we're providing here is, one, let's eliminate that step of the subsequent trial and say if a collateral source, other than those that are by law required to seek subrogation, which is the return of that money, just your plain old everyday insurance company, let's just no-fault that. We're not going to require another trial, another filing of a case to get that money back. Let's just say if it's a collateral source and you paid it, this person paid premiums to get that coverage, you provided it, it's called square. The idea again being that the person is made whole. What isn't covered by insurance then certainly is a claim that can be looked at by the court. And we're saying that that information should be provided to the jury so that they can participate in this and have a full understanding of the facts of the case and do their own reductions rather than be in the dark, so to speak, about whether this person has other kinds of coverage or not. And I think that's a pretty good capsulized, because the next one's kind of thorny also. Apportionment of fault, section 16. There was, once upon a time, and unfortunately it has returned to a degree, a theory of apportionment of fault called joint and several liability. Basically what it meant was that if I'm injured and there are three persons that share some degree of responsibility for my injury, joint and several, the theory of joint and several liability basically said that all three of those people are jointly or severally responsible for my damages. If two of these folks that are responsible don't have any money, and the third has a whole lot of money under joint and several, the third probably is going to end up paying everything. The jury's award apportion fault, in other words, the jury, it is a jury question and a jury determination of what percentage of fault each person should pay. But if under joint and several, these two don't have any money, how much percentage of fault they were apportioned by the jury doesn't make any difference. That deep pocket pays it all. In 1988, the state had an initiative on the ballot that I think clearly sought to eliminate joint and several liability. Unfortunately, some of the wording of the initiative, once it was passed, was taken to court and interpreted to not totally do this, because the wording of it said, if you are a party to the suit, you will be apportioned a percentage of fault, and that is all that you will have to pay. What they should have said, it was later discovered after that phrase was examined by the court, was any person responsible will have their appropriate percentage of fault determined by the jury, and that's all they will have to pay. Consequently, the ability to define who it is you're going to bring into the as a party to the suit still exists because of that niche. The ability of a defendant to try to establish the guilt of someone who's not a party to the suit now requires that that defendant separately sue to enjoin that other person into this case and have them present so that the apportionment can be made to be a party to the suit. It was not, I think, the intent of the initiative that is what would happen, and that's what we're trying to represent in this statute, or this provision of the statute, or bill, that the idea of apportionment of fault to all parties responsible should, as much as the law can allow, exist, whether the plaintiff decides to bring them in themselves or not. That basically is what the apportionment of fault, apportionment of damages sections provide. There can be a lot of discussion about all of that, but believe me, most of it has to go towards whether this is a good idea or a bad idea, and to that extent, we don't want to start. Yeah.
Representative Croft.
Not going to that at all, but is there a provision that ensures a consistency between the different suits on this? I see Section 18 provides that an assessment against a person who is not made a party is not binding on them because they were not a party. Is there any other provision in this that makes that binding, or it's just successive suits?
To a non-party? No. Perhaps a qualification to that would be that, as I'm sure you're aware, and many other people aren't, the relationship between a workers' comp case and a tort case is existing law that we're not trying to change. And by law, if an employee is injured on the job, the employer, because of the workers' comp statutes, stands if there were negligence involved in the injury, stands to pay all of the compensation awarded under workers' comp. Workers' comp has, well, I won't editorialize it. Workers' comp has limited the scope and areas of awards, but it requires the employer to be totally responsible for the negligent injury or damage to employees. Sometimes these cases get, notwithstanding that, over into a regular tort case because the theory is that there is this third-party defendant, this other entity that may have shared some of the responsibility for the injury, notwithstanding the fact that under workers' comp laws, 100% of it was paid over here. So to the extent that that law exists, the employer is not, basically is still within what we're providing here. They can't be named, as opposed to they weren't named for whatever reason. And while we're saying that they can have a percentage of fault apportioned to them by the jury, it's not something that they will ultimately be held responsible for, except when they try to get a workers' comp lien against the judgment. We're saying that we have made some adjustments in that, which we'll see when we get to them.
You do that. I'm not trying to editorialize at all. I'm just trying to understand it. I sue you, saying it's your fault. You say it's Ethan's fault. Ethan's not a party. The jury believes you, and they say actually it's zero Porter and 100% Ethan's fault. My only remedy then is to sue him. I mean, do it in a subsequent suit. By this provision, if I'm reading it correctly, and that's all I'm asking, it's not a determination of his liability. I've got to establish that in the next action. It's not binding on him.
It's a determination of this jury's opinion of what the percentage of fault that person who, for whatever reason, is not present is. But it is not a determination that results in that person having to pay anything because they weren't there. And in some cases, we have discussed with workers' comp, they can't be there. So when you hear the empty chair position, it's something that happens now under existing law in any of those cases where one of the parties that's responsible as an employer.
Nothing maybe Mr. Croft would settle with me is all.
Yeah.
Section 19 is pretty simple. Another recommendation of the task force, and this makes it clear that that exception that we mentioned before, that intentional acts are exceptions to the liability of tort claims. So if you were injured because of someone else's intentional act, you certainly can file a tort claim. Section 20 basically puts some specificity to expert witness qualification. The the attempt, as you can see, is to try to get someone who, try to get an expert that is as close as possible to mm-hmm. being in the same ballpark with the person who the allegation is against. Offers of judgment.
I'm going to say it once more. We only have 35 more minutes, and so we may have to just jump to those that might be controversial, and we don't want to get bogged down on something we'll take up a week from last Wednesday in discussion of the bill. So if it's a clarification...
It's a clarification. This expert witness qualification is different than the evidentiary rules?
Yes. Subsequently, we'll be changing the evidentiary rules. Offer of judgment is, again, building on a procedure that was suggested by the governor's task force. Offers of judgment are, after a case has been filed, one party or the other can make a formal offer to settle the case. And what we're trying to do is to inspire reasonable offers and reasonable assessment of those offers and taking them if they are reasonable, consequently eliminating the costs of the process up to and including the trial, which is a cost to both parties and the state and everybody else. The task force recommendation was a increase in the rate of prejudgment interest. And that was a higher rate of prejudgment interest if you made an offer and it was refused and the settlement actually came out worse than what you should have accepted. If that offer was made real early, then it would be real expensive to you if that happened. And a little bit less if it was made later, and a little bit less if it was made later. We're adopting that same procedure. But we think that the amount of prejudgment interest, especially in light of the fact that cases now, and there's a section in here that makes it clear, don't allow prejudgment interest after the judgment. They actually used to, but cases now have said can't do that. That really isn't that big an inducement anymore. Consequently, what we're saying is that if this offer is made within a short period of time from the ability that you would have after a case is filed to get discovery, so you kind of know where you're at. If a short period of time after that, the offer is made, 60 days after that, and you don't accept it, and when you finally go to trial, the offer is within 5% of less than what you would have settled for, you've got to pay all reasonable actual attorney's fees and costs from the time the offer was made until the judgment was entered. That is an inducement. If the offer is made later than that 60 days after discovery, it goes down to 75%. If it's made just really a short time, 30 days before trial or something, then it goes down to 50%. Obviously, it is intended to make people as early on as possible assess their positions and make reasonable offers and have them accepted. Section 22 provides that the current Rule 82 provision of basically a Rule 82 provides that the prevailing party in a suit is entitled to receive a graduated percentage of their attorney fee costs based on how much the judgment is. And we're saying that there isn't any conflict here. In most cases, the offer of judgment that we're providing cost would be more than Rule 82 fees anyway, and so that would prevail in those rare instances, if there were one, that a Rule 82 recovery would be more than what the offer of judgment recovery was, that you'd be able to get the Rule 82 recovery. Section 23 is basically the provision that we mentioned, that instead of saying the absolute 10.5% for prejudgment interest, we're going to make a floating rate that's based on the 3 points above the 12th Federal Reserve District discount rate, which is the standard kind of thing.
Just a question, Representative Porter. Why do we have an adjustable rate here in 10.5% earlier on?
Well, the attempt is to make the rate more favorably represent the value of money at the time that it's going on. 10.5 has been in existence for a long time. Under this, if this were law right now, the rate for prejudgment interest for this year would be 8%, which is 2.5% different than what that fixed rate is. In a high inflation, of course, it would go up above 10.5, but it should, the theory is, and this again was something that was looked at and agreed upon by the task force, that floating rate is more, I think they had a different standard. We've had this one in the bill for a long time, but it does reflect the task force to the extent that it reflects a floating rate as opposed to a fixed rate.
Maybe I can just speed this up. Are you referring to page 2, line 31?
Right.
Representative Porter, were you just trying to keep, not change the 10.5 in an unrelated section?
Yes, yeah. That's correct.
In the same with section 26, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay.
Okay, 24, prejudgment interest. As we said, these two cases, McConkie v. Hart and Anderson v. Edwards, have established that prejudgment interest should not be awarded after judgment, which...
On future economic damages,
I'm sorry, yeah. And it seemed to me that was somewhat obvious, but here we go. Anyway, we're saying that that is the case, and basically what we're saying is that existing case law is now memorialized in statute, so that you don't have to go to the law books to look it up. You can actually find it in statute.
Representative Berkowitz.
Wait, future, we're talking about subsequent to the time of the injury or subsequent to the time of the judgment?
To the extent that we described future economic damages, my wages into the future.
And future non-economic as well.
And future non-economic, right. If there is an award given at the time of the award for future earnings and future non-economic damages, pre-judgment interest, which is basically the money that I might have earned on the money that you owed me, which we've established here, but in theory began the date that I was injured, that's prejudgment interest, and it should accrue from the time of the injury up until the judgment.
Clarification only.
Okay. Prejudgment interest. Okay, that's that. Section 25. Consistency change that applies to Section 23 interest rate to judgments against the state. That just basically brings that floating rate into the same thing that applies to the state. The Section 26 actually is another area of the law that for some reason had been tied to that fixed rate in the tort area, and we don't want to change that. Not that it might not be appropriate, but because of single subject, we can't change it. Section 27, voluntary arbitration, is a conforming amendment, really, in the areas of collateral source as it addresses medical malpractice cases. You'll see after we get further into this that medical malpractice tort cases for some reason took off on a different track over the years and had a whole bunch of individual considerations. And what we have tried to do to a certain extent is kind of bring them back in and make them consistent with other tort cases. And to that degree, because of what we've done previously, we're eliminating a section of that. Medical advisory panels. First section, section 28, is again from the governor's task force and very appropriately makes these the advice of medical panels in medical malpractice cases available to those cases that where the allegation is against a state or municipal health person. It also in section 29 provides specifically, which the law hadn't previously and it caused some litigation, whether or not the panel may consider the omission of a healthcare provider as opposed to just commissions by the and that in section 30 it kind of speeds up the discovery process so that the trial and the tort proceedings can get underway. Section 31 makes it clear that the advisory panel is also an appropriate to use them in cases where prisoners in correctional settings have made these kinds of allegations. Section 32 and 33 basically are just definitions that were not previously in and are now being offered for the medical malpractice section of the chapter.